Hi everyone, and thanks for listening to Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Thea. Today, I'm joined by Chris Hadfield to talk about his book, Sales Psyche, a guide to mastering a healthy and high-performing mind. Chris is the founder and coach at Sales Psyche. He has spent the last 15 years in sales, leadership, and coaching roles and has a passion for supporting people in unlocking their potential and creating a healthier mind. Chris is a qualified coach and has worked with companies such as Meta, Google, Experian, Salesforce, Virgin Media, and O2. Additionally, he can be found on TikTok, sharing content and tips on working on attachment theory, attracting over 150,000 followers. Sales Psyche is the first book that focuses on the salesperson's mind and well-being. Unlike traditional sales books fixated on skill sets, this guide delves into the overlooked realm of mental and emotional tools, fostering a healthy and high-performing mindset essential for getting results and a progressive career in sales. Well, hi, Chris. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on our Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your book. But first of all, how are you today?
I'm very well, Taya. Thank you so much for having me on. Excited to share about this and to go into a bit more detail around some of the key areas.
Absolutely. And I'm also looking forward to it. So my first question, Chris, is why did you decide to write the book Sales Psyche?
Yeah, so my background, I've been in sales pretty much my whole career, fell into sales like most people did back in the day. And I'd like to think it's more by design now, which is showing where the industry is going. But I found throughout my sales career, particularly at the start, is what got me curious about what I do now is struggling with a lot of my anxiety. Didn't really find anywhere to kind of better understand myself. And that, of course, years ago was the case for a lot of things. But as I went through my sales career within selling, coaching, enablement, managing, I recognized that there wasn't really much focus or resources or support around well-being, around mindset. A lot of the training was around skill set and process, and mindset was almost just like a tag along at the end, just saying you've got to have a growth mindset, you've got to be resilient, you've got to be confident, just sort of like postage note statements without really any education around it. It's the equivalent of saying you've got to get better at questioning. Well, yes, but how do I do it? And I just found that particularly when it came to that and the well-being side of things, that it was a very reactive approach, waiting for someone to be burnt out, not hitting target, not where they want to be, thinking of leaving or left before something was done. And I just found that absurd, really. That sales is one of the most unpredictable and variable environments you can work in, which are all kind of things that can influence and sway your mind and your mental well-being, not just on a day-to-day or week-to-week, but an hour-by-hour basis. And to not see anything kind of supporting people around this. And then when I did go and look for resources around the mind or well-being, all the kind of resources and books I read were written for people who weren't in sales. And that again was like, surely there needs to be something for people in sales that can speak to them, that speaks their language, rather than getting them to have to go and do the hard work. It's like going, oh, you know, I want to cook this Italian food, but there's no Italian cookbook. So I've got to go and find another sort of cuisine and translate it, which is what you're kind of asking salespeople to do a lot of the time. So those were some of the key reasons as to why I wanted to write this.
Absolutely. And sales job is a very demanding one where the two want people's mind is enormous. So before we talk about the different impacts that the sales jobs have on salespeople's mind, could you tell me what are the benefits for salespeople who proactively work on their mental well-being? What are benefits in terms of performance and also outside of their sales job and outside of work?
Yeah, I think there's some really interesting kind of approaches here around this. And I think, you know, when we talk about well-being, and this is why when I put in the title, it's not just about creating a healthy mind. It's also linking it and going, look, by taking care of your well-being, you can actually link it to your performance. You can actually see an uplift as a result of this. And I think people don't always associate that. They think well-being is just about, I've just got to take care of myself, whether it's an organization or an individual, but it can have a dramatic impact on your performance. So yeah, leading on from that, there's a number of studies that I reference actually in the book itself. For example, a survey by McKinsey and Company reported that salespeople who feel they have a good work-life balance are 32% more likely to stay with their company and 21% more likely to exceed their sales targets. Or if you take, for example, The Happiness Advantage, which is a book that a few people might have read listening to this, where they found that people with a healthier well-being and happiness outperform their counterparts by 37% in revenue and 31% more productive. So it's again, it's not just about going, oh, well, I'm taking care of myself. It's going, this is actually having a direct impact on your performance as well. But I think the kind of key overview of the benefits from it is, first of all, it helps with consistency. If you're just going in and sort of going hell for leather, the amount of times I've seen salespeople become so inconsistent because they even reach burnout, which isn't, they think, oh, I need to reset myself. But obviously, over time, that's taking a toll on your body. Every time you go through that, you might think, oh, I just wait and then I'll have a break and then I'll come back to it. But that is still having an impact on you. And of course, it's still having an impact on your performance because it's going up and down. It's obviously impacting your well-being and your self-talk as well. And obviously, outside of work, this is where the big impact can be felt. Is, if you are taking care of your well-being, you allow yourself to be more present with things outside of work. You allow yourself to be able to switch off more and enjoy things. So there's an immense amount of benefits directly within your role and your career and your performance, but also outside of work as well, where you're going to feel more present, you're going to feel more relaxed and more present with things.
Absolutely. And you mentioned burnout, and interestingly, in a book, you say that surveys show that 89% of salespeople feel burnt out. So, could you share what are some of the biggest hidden causes of burnouts in a sales profession?
Yeah, I think there's three that I talk about in the book. And the reason why I went for hidden, because I think, sometimes people can think, oh, lack of sleep is one, or, sort of constantly missing target, for example. But the hidden ones are the biggest ones. The first one is unsustainable drive. I'm not telling anyone don't be driven, of course, don't be ambitious. But it's a bit like going to the gym or going for a run. You feel really good at the end of it. The old adage, you never regret a workout or a run. But if you tried to do that run or that workout or any hobby you have, at some point your body would fail on you. Even if you felt great in that moment, if you tried to go and do that hour session again or that 5, 10K run, your body at some point would cramp up or just go, no, can't do this. And we were very aware of that of our body, but in our mind, it's the same thing. And the key thing here is not saying, don't try and keep being ambitious and driven, but it's asking yourself, if you've had a really good quarter or a good month or a good week, before going, right, I'm just going to do that all over again, is asking, is this sustainable? Because it's very easy to go, right, I had a really good quarter, a good year, let's just keep going. And it's going, is this sustainable? And if not, how do I make it sustainable? Just asking that question. It might still be that you do the same things, but you're doing it with intention. Because the danger is you keep doing this, you go to burnout, but you also create some limiting beliefs there of the only way I can be successful is if I work every single weekend, or if I never take leave until Christmas, for example, which obviously over time is going to have a big impact on you. So that's the first one is unsustainable drive. Because it's if you're putting your body in that, it's a bit like sticking yourself in fifth gear constantly and just like going and going and going, or going back to first gear and then second and third and not refueling. The nature of sales, it's a bit like I talk about this in the book, like a Formula One race. When you're in sales, it's very easy to think, oh, if I'm ahead, I can't stop because I'm going to lose momentum. If I'm at the back or under target, I'm going to fall further behind. But like an F1 race, wherever you are on the grid, you've got to come in and refuel. You've got to change your tires, otherwise you will burn out at some point. The second one is neglecting your non-work identities and own needs. So it's very easy in sales to allow your number to become your identity, to become, this is who I am. This is what determines my success or my failure. And when you place all of your identity into that and things aren't going too well, then that's where you can struggle and you lose perspective and you think, oh God, I'm just not where I want to be, and can sort of over amplify it, staying in that state for longer. Or when things are going well, you can again almost just immerse yourself into this and forget all the things that probably motivate you as to why you do what you do with your family and your friends and so on. So it's really about ensuring, because if you are just doing that, that's where the burnout can happen, because you're putting all your time and energy into this. And when things aren't going well, you're placing all of your value and self-worth into one particular aspect when there are many. So your non-work identities could be a brother, a sister, a boyfriend, girlfriend, auntie, uncle, parent, dog mum, dog dad, whatever it might be, volunteer, coach. And the thing I would encourage people to do, and again, all of these things I reference in the book, is first of all, ask yourself, like, what are 3 to 5 key identities that I play outside of work? And how do I bring value to them, first of all? Like, if it was a job description, what would be my key responsibilities? How do I show up for this? And secondly, what does success look like? How do I know if I'm showing up? What's the KPI of being a good brother or a good partner or a good parent or friend? Because we're very clear, if someone said to you right now, what's your, how are you measured at work? Straight away, you'd be able to say in sales, it's my number, it's number of calls, it's meetings booked, it's revenue, whatever it might be. What's your role? Oh, well, I do this, this, and this. If I ask someone that, if you were listening to this now, and I said, what's your KPI as a ex, auntie, uncle, whatever it might be, probably wouldn't give me an answer straight away. So it's becoming clearer on that. Not to care less about work, like, this is another thing. It's not saying by thinking more about the things you should care less about this, but it's caring more about these other things. Just by caring more about something doesn't mean you have to care less about something else. It's providing more perspective, because on some weeks, in the nature of sales is things won't go to plan. You might not move deals forward. Even though you've done all the work, you might not see anything. But on that week, you might have showed up really well as a brother or as a friend or as a partner. And it's being able to identify and go, look, maybe I didn't see as much progress here. I'm not saying I don't care about it. It's not creating toxic positivity going, I'm just going to ignore this. But here's how I did show up. Because it gives your brain that feedback of, well, look, we're still doing things. This week hasn't been a write-off. We haven't just wasted a week or a month of our life. We've been showing up in different ways. And then the third thing is a lack of self-recognition is what leads to burnout. And not just burnout, imposter syndrome, negative self-talk, unhealthy comparison. Our brains are always looking for ways to compare, to like analyze where we're at. And if we're not doing it internally, we'll do it externally. And if you're constantly chasing, never reflecting, you're subconsciously telling your brain, it's never enough, it's never enough, it's never enough. You know, you keep climbing the mountain, you're never acknowledging, well, I'm at this base camp, I'm at this point. And self-reflection also, again, it's not just about your well-being, it's about your performance, to go, what is working? What can I tweak? Rather than being overly reliant on external feedback or external validation or reassurance, which is what people find. And then you start to go, oh, what does someone think of me? Am I doing a good job? You know, you get the shout outs, you get the mentions, you get the awards, they feel good in the moment, then that feeling dissipates very quickly. You hit your target, you close the deal, it feels good, and you're back to them wondering, oh, I need to justify myself. And self-recognition, again, is not about, you know, it's kind of going, look, I might not be where I want to be yet, but I'm probably further along than where I was. And if you go for a walk, if you go for a hike, you go for a run, you look around along the way. No one goes for a run to get to the end of it. No one goes for a hike to get to the end of it. You don't watch a film to get to the end of it. You don't read a book to get to the end of it. You do it for the thing in the middle. So it's about digesting that. Whenever you think, oh, what was your favorite film? No one just goes, oh, it ended like this. And then you talk about what happened, story. And it's the same with the self-reflection. So when you're not giving yourself that, you're not giving your brain that input and that feedback. It's like, well, we just need to keep going and going and going, and not giving yourself the checkpoints along the way.
Absolutely. Well, I think those are really profound insights. And I also, there's another metaphor that you make in the book about our mind being like our phone battery, and it needs recharging all the time. It's probably sales people forget to do that very often. So let's talk a little bit about those hidden causes of burnout. So you mentioned limiting beliefs and also negative self-talk. So you touched briefly on that, but could you share some strategies to deal with those?
So again, I think it's this I start the book with this because, well, the first part, because I think it is the fundamental basis for everything. You know, in sales, we're very conscious of the conversations we have with prospects, with customers, with colleagues, how we present the product, the vision. But the conversation you have with yourself sets the tone for every other conversation you have. And a lot of the time, we are very conscious of how others speak to us or how we speak to others, but less so about how we speak to ourselves. And that can have a huge impact on our performance and our well-being. Is the conversation you're having is what am I telling myself going into this sales call or this cold call or this presentation or this interview or this meeting or this presentation? Is it something that is supporting me? Is it something that's actually only impacting me? And the most common thing I find when I work with salespeople is this negative self-talk a lot of the time. Now, I'm not someone to sit here and say you just should be positive self-talk, positive thinking, because I think this where people struggle with it is because I think it, first of all, can make it feel like it is toxic positivity. You can't just tell yourself, oh, it'll be fine, it'll be all right. Because if you're thinking that way, your brain is doing it for a reason and it's trying to look for some ways to sort of proactively work on these things. But also, sales doesn't always work out well. Like, you know, you will lose the majority of your deals in sales and still be successful. So if you try and tell yourself everything will be fine and it isn't, your brain is just going to keep going, well, told you so. We shouldn't have thought so positively. So it's not trying to think positively here, it's trying to think more neutrally. So there's a tool that I go into in a lot more detail in the book. Notice it, name it, neutralize it. So notice it, first of all, is talking a bit around like the triggers. Notice your triggers. When do you notice that self-talk showing up more or those limiting beliefs? You know, our brains are very much like Google. Anything you type in, they'll come back with evidence. If you're saying, this call isn't going to go well, I'm not good with public speaking or presenting, your brain's going to go and look for all the evidence linked to confirmation bias to back it up and go, yeah, do you remember the last time you did that presentation and this happened? Or, yeah, do you remember, look at all these things that could go wrong on this call and amplify that feeling. And the more we think about something, the bigger it is, you know. And that's all the difference here is we're still thinking about these things on a daily basis, but because we put more attention into these things, that's what can overwhelm us. It's a bit like walking down the street and seeing a car driving on the road. You know, there's part of you going, that car could swerve into me, but you're not thinking about it as the main thing. But if you did, that would probably petrify you to the point where you wouldn't want to go and walk on a pavement. So we're conscious, but you're neutrally thinking there. You're thinking that could happen, but you're also like, well, they're driving, I'm here, you know, it's daylight, they can see me, all these other things. But it's when you amplify a feeling that you then start telling your brain this is something to worry about. And this is where phobias and other things can come in as well. But noticing it is noticing your triggers. If you know that speaking to a certain person triggers you, if you know that when someone says, can you present, triggers you, you know that when you get to the third week of the month or the last month of a quarter triggers you. You can preempt it and go, right, I know I'm going to start feeling like this. So going through a tool like this, or I know I'm going to start maybe having some irrational thoughts. But you can also start to go, well, how do I work on that? Because if you can find out the core of what's happening, you can work on it rather than what a lot of people do when it comes to presenting, for example, or cold calling is, oh, thank God that's over. Thank God that's over. And it's like, well, how do you work on the thing that's causing you that feeling rather than just feeling the relief at the end of it? So notice it, name it. Name it is where you're writing down all those things. Like, what are the things that you think are going to happen? What are you worried about? What's that person going to say? Because when you write, you have to use the rational part of your brain as well. And then the neutralize it part is where you ask, you can go two different routes here. I'll focus on the first one, but there's a second approach in the book. The first one is where you want to validate your thoughts. So this isn't about ignoring or telling yourself, you know, what you're thinking isn't right. It's just going, let me just think about the validation of it. If you imagine your brain is like a courtroom and you've got the prosecution throwing out these accusations, this isn't going to go well, you're not going to hit your target, this person isn't going to buy into you, they're going to think this of you, is asking yourself, where is the evidence this thought is true? Because when you ask questions, you have to use the rational part of your brain as well. So where is the evidence this thought is true or false? Like the actual proof. A lot of the time there won't be. Your brain might go, well, this happened one time, you know, last month or 6 months ago. And you might go, well, how many times have I done it since? 30. Well, it's happened once out of 30. Okay. So if it this difficult scenario has happened one out of 30 times, flip it the other way. If you'd only had one good outcome and 29 bad ones, would you be sitting here going, this is a really good thing No, you'd be saying this is bad because I've had 29 bad outcomes. So if it's the other way around, it's quantifying it and putting it into context. But it's also asking yourself, where is the evidence? Because your brain might go to, well, there isn't any, or it's based on the past, or it's based on someone else that you've seen or experienced, but you've never actually experienced firsthand. And then what else could be true here? You're not telling yourself this isn't right. You're saying what else could be true? You're looking at other possibilities. You're going, well, actually, what else could be true here is this person just hasn't seen my email yet. Or this person behaved in that way because they've got their own stress going on and they've got their own targets to hit. And again, it's not denouncing any responsibility from any actions you do in the future, but it's avoiding you jumping to one conclusion around it. So that is a tool which I dive far more into detail. But I think once you can start practicing this proactively as well, picking scenarios you know trigger you, what you're doing over time, you're retraining your brain to think a different way so that when these things come up in the future, you're like, oh, trigger, notice it, name it, neutralize it.
Well, I think that sounds like a very useful trigger. Sorry, very useful tool. But another cause of burnout that you mentioned earlier on was comparison, and we know that it could be harmful in many ways. But is it possible for comparison to be useful in sales?
Yeah, it's, I think, in the same, I talk about a lot of this in the book. It's not the thing that's good or bad, it's what you do with it, in the same way with emotions that we can maybe come to. But, you know, comparison is like anything. You know, you look at social media, it's not good or bad, it's what you do with it that counts, or how you use it. But comparison can be useful. And I talk about comparison theory in there. You've got upward social comparison and downward social comparison. Upward social comparison in a healthy form. Because I go back to my original point, just for a bit more context, is that our brains are always looking to assess where we're at. We want to know, you know, are we doing the right things? Are we on the right course? And upward social comparison in its healthy form is there to go, look at these people doing really well around me. Isn't that inspiring? That gives me an idea of where I can get to. You know, oh, I could get through that sort of career development and be promoted into that position. I could maybe aspire to get to that level of maybe starting a business like that. Downward social comparison in its healthy form is to go look at people who maybe aren't doing as well as me. I'm really grateful for what I have. I'm glad I've got this. I recognize what I've done to be able to do, achieve this, but also like what I'm fortunate to have as well. Now, when those become unhealthy, upward social comparison is, oh God, look at these people doing really well. I'm never going to get to that level. And downward social comparison is that could be me next. Now, you saw this a couple of years ago with people obviously, unfortunately, losing their jobs, like lots of announcements on LinkedIn. People starting to go, even though their company hadn't said anything, they were like, this could be me because you see it around you. But comparison in its healthy form can be right. And it comes down to how you respond to it. You know, if you're saying to yourself, if you're looking at it as, oh God, like, why is this person doing this? And you haven't been doing that internal comparison that I talked about as well, then you don't have an idea of your own value and worth. You look at others' success and you start to feel resentment towards it or jealousy. And what your brain is doing with every interaction you have on a daily basis, whenever you speak to someone, see someone online or offline, is, are they a friend? Are they a foe? Are they someone I can trust? Are they someone that could potentially threaten me? And if your initial responses are like this and you're not working on that self-comparison, that internal recognition, your brain starts to see them as a foe. And that's when you start to go, oh, like, look at them, they're so lucky, like always doing, always closing deals like this, or confirmation bias. You start going, they're getting special treatment. And of course, that just leads down a slippery road because then you're not working on your own recognition and you're only being sort of like suppressed even more by other people's success around you. So it's almost going, you know, and it's kind of looking at it a different way, changing it to a question again and going, what can I gain from this? What's the benefit from this? Rather than going, oh, there's 10 people in my team doing really well. Imagine if you're working in a company and no one was doing well. Imagine if no one was hitting target. Would that, you'd be like, well, you know, yeah, you might think, well, I'm not alone, but it's like, well, there's no one to really learn from here. Like, how do I know what's the right thing to do? Isn't it good to have people in the team that are that way? And as soon as you start to change it from looking at like, oh, they're so lucky, they're so this, is what is it I think that I like about them? Or it can be, oh God, that person's so good at that. they're so naturally confident. They're so there's a natural. There's a big challenge there, of course, because you know a lot of these things are worked on. No one comes out of the womb naturally presenting or naturally confident. It's developed in different ways. But the more you do that, the more you sit from afar and admire them, and you pedestal them, and you make them seem like this Hollywood actor or actress that you can never get to. But as soon as you go, what is it that I appreciate about them? Rather than go, oh my God, they're so good at presenting, or they're naturally good at this, is what do I like about how they present, or they cold call? I really like the questions they ask, or how they open. Okay, what could I do to make that my own? What could I do to learn more about how I can do this? I could go and speak to them. I'm not saying I have to copy their approach, but I could maybe take bits of it. I could maybe think about my opener. But as soon as you start asking those questions, you start getting curious of it and using them as a source of information, whether it's directly or indirectly, to develop, rather than sitting from afar and either thinking this person's moving further away from where I'll ever be, or building that resentment or jealousy around it.
Yeah, it really shows how comparison can be useful in some ways when you reframe your mind to make it useful. And another thing that you discuss in the book is the role of luck in sales. And luck is a word that you can often hear in a sales profession, especially when it's related to success. So why do you think salespeople shouldn't put their success or even their failures down to luck?
Yeah, I think luck is such again, it's something you hear all the time. I'm aware of that. I'm not saying like by writing this book, people are going to eradicate it, but it's just changing the language in response to it, because the danger of looking at everything as lucky or unlucky, lucky, I'm so lucky to close that deal. I'm so lucky to have this, or to be in this position, or so unlucky. I'm always unlucky with these kind of opportunities. Is when you put it down to luck, when something is lucky, again, you don't take ownership of, well, what did you do to get here? What did you do? It's not by accident completely, it's by design as well. Like, own it. Because otherwise, every time you think you're lucky, you don't give yourself credit for what you've achieved. You don't recognize what you did. You just put it down to some chance. And unlucky then means you feel like the world is against you, and you start thinking it isn't fair and there's injustice. And of course, the old adage our parents always used to say, life isn't fair, it's true. But the more you look at that, the less you focus on, again, what I would frame it to is what you can control. And the thing I talk about in the book is, rather than thinking about lucky versus unlucky, is controllable versus uncontrollable. That's a far healthier and more constructive way to look at it. So rather than going, I'm so lucky to have closed that deal, is I did this and this within my control to close that deal. And little note here, when we talk about uncontrollables, a lot of the time I hear people talk about them as negative, but there can be positive uncontrollables. Rather than going, I got so lucky that person I like picked up when they were looking, or they got in touch, is, well, no, what did you control? You still had to have a good phone call with them in order for them to feel like, yeah, I want to buy into this company or this person. The uncontrollable was, yeah, it was their timing. You couldn't control that, but that was a positive uncontrollable. It wasn't luck. And then the other way around is, rather than going, oh God, I'm so unlucky, is what could I do within that situation? Was there anything I can control? Maybe there wasn't. And if there wasn't, that's okay. It's going, well, here's the things I couldn't control. Because sometimes when you're like, I'm so unlucky, that can cause people to change their approach. But your approach might have been spot on. It might have just been something out of your control that happened. You go and change your approach, that would have been working, but it's because you change it so quickly. So, and I think what you allow yourself to do when you focus more on the controllables and uncontrollables is allow to create more repeatable processes. If you know what you did within your control to close that deal, to get to that target, to have that conversation, to get that promotion, you then know, right, how can I start building this as a system? How do I make this a habit? What can I do next time? And then you start to know when things maybe aren't going as well. Am I still doing those things? Yes. Okay. What's changed? What are there some uncontrollables here? But you allow yourself to focus more on that. And then when things don't go to plan, rather than going unlucky or lucky, is, which again, particularly unlucky makes you feel helpless, life isn't fair, is what can I control here? Rather than going, I'm so unlucky, is what could I control? What can I do something about? Because if you just tell your brain I'm unlucky, it won't go and look for solutions. It will just think you're at the mercy of the sales gods.
Absolutely. And something else very interesting that you discuss in the book is the importance of emotions. And you say that a lot of people they treat emotions as threats, but you argue that they should be treated as signals. So why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about anxiety, you could talk about overwhelm, you could talk about feelings like stress as well. Is a lot of the time they're signals. They're trying to get us to pay attention to something, but it's often our response or reaction. There is no such thing as a good or bad emotion. There is a good or bad response or reaction or perception. If you have it's a bit like going on a roller coaster. You put two people on a roller coaster, one loves them, one hates them. They'll both go around, they'll both scream, they'll both feel the same thing, but their perception of that feeling will be different. Like, when you see people get up on stage or you see athletes after the Olympics, were you nervous? No, I was excited. Same feelings, just different way of looking at that feeling. The feeling in the body does not change. It's our perception that changes around it. And if you start to label certain emotions as good or bad, then you might say stress is or anxiety is a bad emotion. You get more anxious about being anxious. You start to worry, I hope I don't feel this today. You start telling your brain this is a scary thing, and if we feel it, this is the worst. It's making it more paranoid. It's like it's a bit like going, I hope I don't fall down the stairs when you're walking down the stairs, or like people say, don't slip on that, and you become more like sort of overthink it almost. So the idea behind that is if you imagine emotions, it's almost like they're the smoke alarm going off. They're not the house on fire. They're just saying, hey, pay attention to something. And a really simple example is when you're thirsty or hungry. When you're thirsty, I'm speaking from a, and I appreciate not everyone in the world will maybe be in that kind of fortunate position here, just for some context. But when you're thirsty, you don't often go, what would happen if I didn't drink for 1 or 2 weeks? Or I hope I don't get thirsty today. You see it as a signal, but thirst could be a scary thing if you don't drink water. You can start feeling lightheaded, dizzy, and pass out. But you see it as a signal. You don't panic every time you need some water, you just go and get some. Within context of what we're talking about here. And it's recognizing you can get your emotions and other feelings to that way as well is rather than going, why is this happening to me? Why am I so stressed? Why am I so anxious? Self-judgment. Again, if someone else was saying that to you, going back to the self-talk thing, Taya, why are you so anxious? Would you feel more or less anxious? More. You'd feel more anxious. So rather than asking that, it's like, what is this trying to tell me? What is the signal here? If this emotion or feeling is tapping me on my shoulder, I'm going to go, what do you want? What is it? What are you trying to tell me? And it might be, I don't feel as prepared for something. I am conscious that something could happen in this call or this meeting. It could be like, let's pick anxiety. I'm anxious about a meeting, a presentation, a demo, whatever it might be coming up. Now, typically you might think, oh God, I'm so anxious. What if this goes wrong? What if this happens? As soon as you go, what is this anxiety trying to tell me? It's trying to tell me that they might ask a question I don't know the answer to. They might throw out an objection that I know we probably might be a bit of a sticking point for us. I'm anxious that there'll be people in the room I haven't met yet. Okay, what can I do in my control, going back to controllables, to work on that? I can preempt that objection and go, look, I know we aren't the best for this, but here's the things that you said that are important to you. I can go and ask someone in the business who might know the answer to that question. I can research the people who are going to be in the room or ask my contact, what do those people want to see? How do they best resonate with information? Or can I speak to them beforehand? I'll go into that room. I'll preempt that objection. I'll answer those questions because I have the information. I'll resonate with those people. If I wasn't anxious, I might not have done any of that. And all I used there was anxiety as a signal to go, look, this is what I'm anxious about. And as soon as I then act on it, I respond to it. It's like hearing the smoke alarm and going to switch it off, versus a lot of the time we'll just sit there and allow it to get louder and louder and louder. And that's when we're going, oh, I can't handle this. So it's always asking of emotions, like, what is this trying to tell me? Any emotion it can be. You could be feeling sad. It could be this emotion is telling me I want to speak to someone. I want to share this. Or maybe I'm feeling overwhelmed. Maybe this is trying to tell me to take some time off and go, look. Just have a rest, have a restful weekend, or take a half day. Always ask yourself, what is this trying to tell me versus why is this happening to me? And you can start to use emotions as signals. And in that scenario of the presentation, you can then go, oh, do you know what? I'm really grateful I was feeling anxious because it allowed me to respond in these ways.
Fascinating. And Chris, I have one final question for you. At the beginning of this conversation, you talked about how you started working in sales and how that made you feel anxious at times, and also that there weren't many resources to help salespeople with their mental health and mental well-being. So, do you think that things are changing at the moment, and salespeople, they have more access to the kinds of resources and help they need?
Yes and no. I definitely see, and it's encouraging to see, and obviously within the book, I've got 20, 25 people in senior roles that are champions of this, exactly this. And it's great to see more companies and organizations doing this. I think we're on the right path. I definitely think there's still this approach of, if a team isn't performing, it's give them more training around skill set, cold calling, objection handling, whatever it might be, rather than delving into the mind side of things. So we are further along, but we aren't anywhere near where we could be with the potential that I think we have, and also the importance that it plays as well. And I think, my aim with this book is that anyone reading it, whether you're an individual contributor now, you could eventually become one day a leader. And I'd like to feel like you can take and start championing this, and you are part of this movement, whether you're a leader reading this and using it with your team. But it is about recognizing that this isn't just about making us feel better. It's also helping our performance, but it's treating each person as a person, not a number or as a target.
Absolutely. And of course, I would encourage our listeners to grab a copy of Self-Psyche to read more about all the interesting insights that you share in the book and the useful tools you talk about. But thank you very much, Chris, for your time today. I think it was a very interesting and insightful conversation that our listeners can benefit from.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Taya. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.